The Islamic Republic has been able to survive. So it is a very clear message for other nations and other countries that we don't have to be bullied around by the United States of America and give up on our rights and our basic human necessities because America is bullying us, right?
Yeah.
It's a very clear message, and they're seeing it more and more. On the other hand, America itself is drowning, not just economically. When we talk about these types of things, you know, all people can think of is like economic and finance. No. Mm. Even their political system, as the leader has said, it's drowning. Right. Mm-hmm. Their social fabric is completely disturbed. Their society is falling apart.
Yeah.
So America is losing its ground, and other nations, other governments are closely watching it.
They are. Sid Mathi, so this phenomenon is very interesting. The way that America tried to sideline Iran and the way that the West tried to target Iran. And, you know, throughout the years, we saw that America invaded Iraq, having claimed that they have weapons of mass destruction. They invaded Afghanistan. And then they started to point the finger at Iran and say that Iran is dangerous. Iran is going to, you know, attack other countries. They're a maniac nation. We had the famous iconography that it's become of Benjamin Netanyahu holding up that picture of a cartoon bomb and saying that we only have a little bit of time left. And now, after all these years have passed and people have seen the true colors of both Iran and America and the Zionists, it's whenever they call out for war with Iran or they try to target Iran in any way, it seems like that the other countries like China and India and Russia and all the other countries in the world sort of just roll their eyes, like, ugh, it's America again. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, it's interesting, right, that how the dynamics on a global level have changed so radically. Because the United States of America, the government in the past was a government that at least superficially it showed a lot of power, a lot of in Arabic, we call it rob, but you can say a lot of power, a lot of bullying, I guess it's really what it comes down to. And a lot of countries in the world were scared of the United States of America. They were scared of financial sanctions. They were scared of running into a war with the United States of America and all these negative repercussions that in the past were seen. Which will occur if you oppose the United States of America, right? Mm-hmm. This is what it used to be like. Now it's very interesting. Like you said, they have not been able to contain Iran. They have not been able to contain Russia. They have not been able to contain China. They haven't even been able to contain Venezuela, which is, in their own words, in their own backyard, let alone come to the other side of the world and try to contain Syria and Bashar al-Assad or try to contain Iraq or, you know, and it's, I mean, it's funny.
I just even, want to point out, yeah, they can't even contain their own people.
Exactly. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's a very beautiful point right there. It hadn't crossed my mind. They can't even contain their own people anymore. So they've totally lost control of the game, you know. And on one side is quite funny, on the other side is quite unfortunate because it seems like, what are we going to do, right? We used to say that, what are we going to do when Trump leaves office? A lot of the comedians on United States television, American television shows, that's what they would say. They said that, man, we had a lot of jokes when Donald Trump was in the office. So what are we going to do now that America has has fallen? You know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up, which Sheikh Ali talked about, was, yeah, we're open, or the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution is open to negotiating, talking, having a dialogue, having relations, having interactions with everybody across the world, right? But what must be kept in mind is, how does a person who is judging the global arena expect a nation such as the Islamic Republic to enter into interactions and relations and discourse with another nation, the United States of America, who has proclaimed itself to be the open enemy of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And so you see a lot of things on the ground since the inception of the Islamic Revolution, 40 years of sanctions against the Islamic Republic, 40 years of warmongering, 40 years of building bases all around this country whether it's and they're all illegal bases, by the way, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, these, you know, former Soviet states, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and these guys, Azerbaijan, Syria.
But just a point there. America claims, and most of the presidents, they would claim that they're not enemies of the Iranian people, but rather the American system, the Iranian government. So how would you counter such a claim?
Yeah, of course. So sanctions are not aimed at a specific government, right? Sanctions are aimed, they end up hurting the people. So, for example, one of the most common things is medical supplies. There's a huge sanctions that the United States of America has imposed on the Islamic Republic, which deals with medical supplies. So these medical supplies, it doesn't affect the government, right, per se. It affects the common people. It affects, and not just the common people that are healthy, it affects the common people that are sick, that are ailing, that need medical aid. And this is just one of the things, right, that it is. So this is a big kind of a, it is a lie, it is a facade that, no, we love the Iranian people, but we're going to sanction the country so that the people are the one who are going to die, right? I don't know, Sheikh Ali, if you want to bring in a point here, I think.
I think you said it all. They're trying to portray as if they are sanctioning the government institutes and government personalities and, you know, the government apparatus, which is a lie. While they are targeting the government and the system, at the same time, majority of these sanctions are impacting the average Iranian's life, right? So when there's inflation, an average Iranian gets affected. When there are no medications that are needed by those people who are suffering from a disease, you know, Iranian people, they end up suffering.
Yeah.
When they target, for instance, universities, it's the Iranian students who are suffering, right? They go after the religious institutions, you know, it's a religious community living in Iran, which it's a predominantly a religious country. They are the ones who are suffering. So it's a lie. Basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the people to rise up against their system. The message that Iran is giving to Iranian nation is that you need to stand up and overthrow this government because we couldn't do it even after enforcing an 8 years long war. We couldn't do it. We couldn't fight these people overseas, even in Syria and Iraq. So now we're really banking on the average Iranians to stand up against their own system, overthrow the government, and overthrow the Islamic system, which is a dream, right? This Islamic system had 98% of people, you know, voting to bring in the Islamic system because, like I said, Iran is a predominantly religious country. So, you know, it's a dream that they're seeing, and now they're through these sanctions, they're making the average Iranian desperate to stand against the system, which has not happened. We have seen it, alhamdulillah, you know. Except for a few infiltrations that America has done by using its, you know, petrodollars and stuff. There was no mainstream movement against the Islamic system in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
This is amazing, right? Despite this all this pressure and despite people knowing that it's the Islamic system because of which America is against us.
Yeah.
They're still not standing up against the Islamic system and Islamic system of governance. This speaks a lot about the people of Iran. And alhamdulillah, it's going to stay this way. You know, yeah. This is what they're trying to do, basically. This is why they are targeting Iran.
That's all we have time for today. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is Viewpoints coming to you from IRIB English Radio.
You're the reason my life's worth living. You're the reason I'm alive. I'd be lost without you. You're the reason that I strive. You're my destiny. You're my revenue. You're the reason that I breathe. You are all that I
at midnight, April 1st, 2015. The thunder of warplanes, accompanied by massive explosions, woke the children of Yemen. Saudi Arabia had initiated a war against Yemen, which, as claimed by the Saudi ambassador to Washington, Adel Al-Jubeir, sought to re-establish the legitimacy of deposed Yemeni president Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi, and also to prevent the Ansarullah movement from dominating the Arab Peninsula country. The sudden invasion, which took place after receiving a green light from the United States and Britain, was the most visible and blatant instance of the Saudi regime's interference in the fate of the Yemeni people over recent years. An overt war waged after al-Saud's ever-duplicitous goals and policies had been met with defeat. But what had taken place within Yemen's political environment that had forced foreign powers to undertake all but open military invasion to change the balance of power in Yemen and secure their aims? How had Ansarullah transformed from a small group to such power that Saudi Arabia contravened international law, acting preemptively to preserve the interests of itself, as well as those of its Persian Gulf allies? These questions can be answered with reference to a decade of tension in Yemen's political atmosphere, which featured barbaric acts such as the Six-Fold Wars, which the incumbent government unleashed upon the Ansarullah, the consequence of which gave Ansarullah greater sophistication and experience by the day. This chronicle dates back some 20 years.
The Heart of Agate, Part 1.
On May 22, 1990, the Republic of Yemen was born out of the union between North and South Yemen, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of the former country, was officially sworn in as the new nation's head of state. However, his discriminatory policies led to discontent among the people and leaders of the South, as well as numerous tensions and crises, eventually causing a civil war in 1994. The war, which is viewed by some as a war of unification and by others as a war of separation, went on for 2 months. During the war, the central government massacred the people of the South and destroyed the area's facilities and infrastructures, enjoying the jurisprudential and spiritual support of Yemen's Muslim Brotherhood, also known as the Reform Movement, and having received the requisite go-aheads and fatwas of the muftis affiliated to the Brotherhood to accuse the Southerners of apostasy. Soon after, on July 7, 1994, Saleh's government conquered Aden, defeating the movement of the South, forcing its leaders to flee.
It was then that the Northerners started establishing dominance over the Southerners. They saw it fit to gain dominance over everything, and Ali Abdullah Saleh managed to fully demolish the South and completely expand his control there.
Saleh embarked on many things. He assumed control of many power centers and spent a lot of money on them.
Of course, these things were not Saleh's doing alone. These were done by the coalition of politicians from his family in Sanhan and Abdullah ibn Hussein al-Ahmar's family in Hashid.
Saudi Arabia's interference in Yemen continued in a direct manner. For instance, it was Saudi Arabia which always supported Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar, and it was the kingdom which helped him rise to his military authority.
Having wearing their inroads and after attaining control over the situation, they, especially al-Ahmar, were seeking to become the main puppeteers in Yemen.
Wealth was drawn around these people and the hypocrites around them, and the country turned into an area of ransacking and plunder.
And following Saleh's victory, he was faced with the demand to form a national unity government. The formation of such government would appease the losers of the war. The winners, however, rejected the proposal.
One of those severely insisting upon national unity was Sayyid Badruddin al-Houthi, the leader of Zaydi Houthis,
who was a great erudite belonging to the city of Houth, south of the Sa'ada Governorate. He is one of the pillars of the Zaydi sect.
Sayyid Badruddin is one of the Zaydi sect's prominent scholars and jurisprudents. He's also the father of Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi. And the current leader of the Houthi movement is Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi.
And they conspired against the brothers, whom they considered to be their opponents and real enemies, though those brothers were the followers of the House of Muhammad, the Zaydi sect, and the noble people from the Fals, and much oppression and torture was brought about.
It had been going on for a while that some of those around Saleh, who had supported him in the war, were throwing tantrums. They were subjects of the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this was an element which was a potential threat to Saleh's government in the long run. From Saleh's perspective, Zaydis were the only people whom he could pit against the Brotherhood, should he see fit.
And since Saleh knew this fact, he resorted to the divide and rule policy, which was being used by Britain at the time. He called the policy dancing on the heads of snakes, through which he would support one side against the other, and in most cases, support both of the sides.
In 1993, the Zaydis, who included a group of scholars, among whom were Sayyid Majduddin Muhammad al-Mu'ayyidi and Sayyid Badruddin al-Houthi, and who mostly resided in the Sa'dar Governorate, created the Al-Haq Islamic Party. It is clear that Saleh's policy at the time was to accommodate developments of this type, and institutions like the Al-Haq Party were able to stand in the face of extremist and radical ideologies in Yemen, including Al-Qaeda. This was a plus for Saleh's government, which was under pressure from the United States to confront Al-Qaeda.
The party, however, roused the opposition on matters of religious emulation by embarking on innovation and being influenced by the revolution of Imam Khomeini. In other words, they mobilized, while those sources of emulation merely espoused jurisprudence, scholarship, and things of that nature.
Therefore, a rift came about between the conservatives and the open-minded. The former comprised the Zaydi scholars and the elder ones, while the latter was led by Mohammed Azan.
But for how long could this go on? There was need for a moderate point of view to converge the two lines of thought and prevent further division and unease. Hussein al-Houthi, a like-minded friend of Azan's, who maintained a moderate position, undertook to do this while engaging in political activity. Sayyid Hussein started to write and propagate his ideology, especially among the young generation.
Hussein al-Houthi was a parliamentarian, a strong personality who maintained innovative thoughts. He had a special charisma which awarded him popularity and fame among Zaydis, especially in Sa'dah.
And Sayyid Badr al-Din al-Houthi maintained a moderate position which caused everyone to find solace in him.
And this made him similar to other notable personalities, great people and religious personages, who undertook to promulgate ideology and educate people.
A time had come that oppression in Yemen had come to a head, and the country was experiencing intellectual, economic, and military invasion and war on its own soil.
After returning from Sudan, he tried to resolve the problems which had grown deeper between the open-minded and conservative movements.
He said, "This studying of yours is just for show. While you're thumbing through books, oppression has thrown its clutches over the country."
In his mind, the problem resided in divergence from the noble Quran. Hence, he started to invite people to return to the holy book.
With every policy that would be issued, he would circulate some Quranic verses and compare the meaning to the existing circumstances.
And then the ideology of revolution and change and refusal to accept the present circumstances was engendered in his mind.
Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi resided in Al-Maran, in northern Yemen, on a mountain that overlooked Saudi Arabia. He embarked upon contemplation as well as addressing and preparing the youth, who developed a strong admiration towards Sayyid and were influenced by him.
So, at that time, he created a group in Saada named Al-Shabaab Al-Mumen and adopted a number of slogans as well as political and cultural inclinations. The movement is essentially a cultural one. In other words, it maintains a cultural plan of action and perspective for its activities and presence.
The movement rose up, devoted to the seeking of justice, and it rejected all foreign intervention as well as oppression, callousness, and tyranny.
He possessed an authoritative presence in Saada. This was alarming for the central government in Sana'a and Yemen's northern neighbor, Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia was the United States' main ally in the region, a fact that had made the kingdom a source of concern for Yemen's government. Saleh was being gradually pressured to act against the Zaydis. What he did, though, was to begin suppressing the main allies of the Saudis, namely the Salafis, instead of fighting the Zaydis.
And after the events of 9/11, the relations between the US and Saudi Arabia became strained since most of the people who carried out the operation possessed Saudi passports. It was then that Saleh thought he could become the US's premier ally in the region.
Saleh tried to ally himself with the US in a coalition against terrorism.
Therefore, he speedily undertook to eradicate the Salafis, especially those who had returned from Afghanistan.
Then the time came when Saleh finally pit the Houthis against the Salafis. But things did not go according to his long-time plans. Instead of confronting and taking revenge on Wahhabis and Salafis, Hossein al-Houthi turned the confrontation into one against the United States.
He did so by declaring he would not accept that U.S. interrogators come and interrogate Yemeni civilians.
Bush started an international war on Islam. He called it war on terrorism. Sayyid Hussein, however, denounced it as a war on Islam.
And he said the U.S. was doing this on a global scale so that we may face a moral defeat and that the killing of Muslims would turn into an everyday matter. He said moral defeat was more dangerous than military defeat and therefore started to chant this slogan.
Therefore, Sayyid Hussein said he would alienate the people from the slogan of fear, and if the government became angry, he would ask them, why do you lose your temper over the US and Israel?
Accordingly, he sought to popularize moral slogans so we do not face moral defeat, and these slogans were aimed to counter that of Bush's, who deceptively said, anyone who is not with us is against us. Ali Abdullah Saleh came to the conclusion that this undertaking of Sayyid Hussein had robbed him of the opportunity to become the US's preferred ally in the region.
And he escalated oppression, tyranny, destruction, torture, and imprisonment.
On January 18, 2004, thousands of soldiers, backed by tens of aircraft, hundreds of tanks, cannons, and other heavy and semi-heavy military equipment, attacked the areas of El Nashur, El Saifi, Maran, and Zahyan in the Saada Governorate. It was the government's first war on the Houthis, which lasted for 3 months.
The person who directed the wars against Zaydi Shias, or Al-Shabaab al-Mumen, was named Ali Mohsen al-Amar and was among those close to President Ali Abdullah Saleh. He, however, was inclined toward Wahhabism, known to maintain such inclination. He received his orders from Saudi Arabia.
The civil war lasted for some time, and then Sayyid Hussein was martyred and his body was confiscated. The body was placed in one of the central prisons in Sana'a in order to be out of reach of his followers, so that his followers could not erect a tomb for him, and so that Sayyid, who was the leader of a movement, could not be paid tribute to.
However, prior to the fall of Mehran, Syed Hussein had ordered Syed Abdullah Malik al-Houthi to be transferred from the area to another. He secretly knew of Abdul Malik's importance without divulging this to anyone else.
The death of Syed Hussein al-Houthi, the leader of the Zaydis, and many of his aides dissipated Saleh's and Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar's concerns regarding the situation in Sadr, especially in light of the fact that the movement had lost its leader.
The Al-Shabaab al-Mumen movement, however, did not go disband, but lived on thanks to the support of Hussein's father and martyr, Al-Amer Badr al-Din al-Houthi.
At the time, negotiations were underway between Ansar and the government. The talks were led by Syed Badr al-Din al-Houthi, who represented Ansarullah.
The government, though, did not live to its promises. Syed Badr al-Din consequently returned to the area of al-Nashur.
Following Syed Hussein's martyrdom, all eyes turned towards Abdullah al-Ruzami, his former colleague in the House of Representatives, with no one even thinking of Abdul Malik. Abdullah al-Ruzami was residing in al-Nashur, and thus Ansarullah members made their way to that area, gathering there.
The area of al-Nashur is very small and surrounded by mountains on every side.
At the time, Syed Abdul Malik said it was a mistake for the Ansarullah to congregate in the area as it is too open and also it is close to a major garrison. He said that it was incumbent upon the movement to spread out and ordered each member to start operating independently in the area. Al-Ruzami disapproved of this idea.
Towards the end of January 2005, Abdullah Saleh waged his second war on the Houthis. On this occasion, al-Ruzami was the leader of the Ansarullah movement's military wing and undertook to direct its defense. Despite the efforts and martyrdom of many of his brethren, this war too ended with the movement's defeat and his arrest on March 27, 2005. As their enemy closed in, Badr al-Din al-Houthi retreated through the impassable mountain range of Sadr together with his remaining fighters.
Some of these fighters would actually tie themselves up to force themselves to stand their ground, and there they would fight until they were murdered.
After this second war, leadership was passed down to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who is now considered the leader of the Ansarullah.
Syed Abdul Malik departed for Matran, which is a strategic area, geographically reinforced. On his departure, he was accompanied by a small number of people, but with time, others joined him, believing in his cause.
It was during this sojourn that people began to be drawn to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the younger son of Sayyid Badr al-Din, despite there being an older brother named Yahya. Abdul Malik, born in 1979 in Sadr Governorate, rose to a leadership rank of Shabab al-Mu'min, owing to his personal characteristic.
Once his popularity was apparent, Abdul Malik started to preach some ideological themes to initiate people with Sayyid Hussein's ways.
He then dispatched youth to Sana'a to spread his ideology. These emissaries were met by the brutality of security forces and thrown into security, political prisons, or other kinds of prisons.
The government commanded them to stay in the mountains and even offered to pay them to do this. But Sayyid Abdul Malik rejected these demands, and hence a third war began, which was the beginning of victories.
It could be interpreted from the measures the government implemented during this third war that it sought to utterly annihilate the movement.
Meetings took place between Saudi Arabia and the US over how to steer the war towards achieving the total eradication of the Houthi movement once and for all. Houthis were bombarded with false accusations and subjected to a massive propaganda campaign.
And when the third war started, most all of the fighters followed the lead of Syed Abdul Malik.
The third war took place in March 2006 under the command of Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar. But this time it was the Houthis that won, delivering a heavy toll upon the aggressors. The victory further affirmed the position of Abdul Malik and the Houthis as heroes among the people, while causing deeper concern for the Yemeni government and consequently the Saudis. Saleh put on a public face, but in secret he was planning vengeance.
Then they released all the prisoners as part of their plan to prepare themselves for a fourth war, which was indeed a war of eradication. Since it was not tactful to kill 800 inmates whilst incarcerated, they released them so they could be killed on the battlefield. Then commencement of the fourth war was violated. Just imagine a sudden onslaught of aggression directed at a single location, with all the weaponry in their position, with around-the-clock attacks. But by the grace of God the Almighty, the defenders withstood this aggression and claimed victory. Warfare ended, leaving the government in defeat and weakened.
بعدها توقفت الحرب ووضعت الحرب أوزارها عجز وهزيمة.
The victors were Ansarullah. The win enabled the group to capitalize on their position and on their wartime experience to negotiate an agreement with the government. But there was a fifth war, and it was during this that the Ansarullah movement increased their claim, managing to free Al-Maran and forcing the government to withdraw from the area as well as many other areas in Sa'ada.
The fifth war began in March 2008 and ended in January the following year with a resounding victory for the Houthis. Their momentum led to a significant growth in awareness of the people who were all invited to become acquainted with the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min's movement, thereafter identified as Ansar Allah.
The movement grew and spread beyond Sa'ada governorate into Hajar, Al-Jawf, and Amran, capturing greater influence in other governorates, expanding remarkably quickly.
And the fighters' faith in Sayyid Abdul Malik's ability to direct the group grew at every stage.
Each time the aggressors started their ways, the Yemeni youth became more resistant, more determined. This was very noticeable following the third war, the fourth and fifth wars. We cannot predict such a phenomenon would occur.
Then there came a sixth war between the government and Ansarullah, with Saudi Arabia and the US ready to prop up the government to join in. Eventually, 28 countries became involved in this war.
Saudi Arabia had supported the Yemeni government in all of its previous wars on Ansarullah. In the sixth one, the Wahhabi kingdom used their own fighters in direct confrontations.
And they sought to enter Sa'ada governorate with military forces in an attempt to destroy outright the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min movement.
Saudi Arabia entered the war directly, decimating suburbs, dropping bombs from their planes, from their American aircrafts.
More than 20,000 houses were destroyed and thousands of people were killed, particularly among the civilians, women, children, and the elderly. In fact, they intentionally destroyed homes while the people were still inside. And in some cases, these civilians lived outside the confrontation zone in peaceful residential areas which did not have relevance to the battleground.
The Yemenis had to understand how dearly it would cost them to adhere to Ansar Allah's ideology. Many people were massacred by the bombardment of Saudi and American warplanes, and many infrastructures and property were destroyed. Compared to the previous wars, the Sixth War was the most vicious and most complicated one for Ansar Allah.
The Sixth War was basically a massacre, which the Yemeni government was carrying out assisted by Saudi Arabia, and even American aircraft had come to the fray. They carried out indiscriminate killings of civilians, and their aim was to inflict the most possible amount of loss and damage. However, the loss suffered by the aggressors, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and other countries which confronted the Ansar Allah movement was so apparent that it made our victories greater.
Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min adopted a new form of self-defense in their fighting, which led to the defeat of the Saudi army, laying bare its weaknesses and disgracing it amongst the other armies of the world. Despite Saudi Arabia possessing highly sophisticated weaponry and equipment, bought mainly from the United States, the kingdom did not manage to conquer anything on the ground. Instead, Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min, otherwise known as the Houthis, managed to advance into Saudi soil, especially in Al-Dukhan and the Al-Jaberi Mountains, where they stayed and left only after signing an agreement with the Yemeni central government. This was an important juncture in the progress made by the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers say coronavirus is more contagious and more lethal than influenza, and we lack the same global protection mechanism. We have prepared for you an article written by Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Why Living with COVID Would Not Be the Same as Flu. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. England prepares to ease coronavirus restrictions further, the messaging from ministers has changed. They said, it seems we have reached a tipping point in the pandemic where rules will be replaced by personal decisions. The mantra now is about living with coronavirus, much as we do with seasonal flu. The pandemic has invited countless comparisons between coronavirus and influenza, and the diseases do have some features in common. Both are contagious, potentially lethal respiratory viruses. They can spread through aerosols, droplets, and contaminated surfaces. And they share some of the same symptoms in the form of fever, cough, headaches, and fatigue. In the winter ahead, one challenge the NHS staff face is separating the COVID patients from the flu cases. But there are striking differences between coronavirus and flu as well, and these matter very much for public health. Coronavirus spreads faster than influenza and can cause far more serious illness. The symptoms of coronavirus can take longer to show, and people tend to be contagious for longer, making them more prone to passing it on. Seasonal influenza has been around long enough that previous infection and protection from vaccines bear down on cases and deaths. Analysis of previous influenza outbreaks suggests that there are value for seasonal flu, the number of people an infected person passes the virus onto averages about 1.28. This means a group of four people with flu might pass the virus onto five more people. Coronavirus spreads more easily than that. For the Delta variant now surging around the world, R is estimated at about 7. So in the absence of vaccines and other interventions, a single case would infect an average of 7 others. As vaccination programs push on and the virus continues to spread, immunity to coronavirus will drive R down. But how low is a moot point. Coronavirus is more lethal than influenza, largely because vulnerability to the disease rockets in older people. Seasonal influenza killed an estimated 44,505 people in England during the three combined flu seasons from 2015, 2016 to 2018, 2019. That number died from COVID in England in the first 9 weeks of 2021. A major difference is that the flu figure takes into account the protection of influenza vaccines, where 50% effectiveness is considered good. Coronavirus vaccines should have a greater proportional impact on COVID deaths. So far, the most common COVID vaccines used in the United Kingdom, the Oxford AstraZeneca and the Pfizer-BioNTech shots, reduce the risk of hospitalization from COVID by more than 90%. As a result, the vaccination program has driven COVID deaths down substantially to fewer than 20 a day in the past week. But the vaccines do much more to prevent death than transmission of the virus. So cases of COVID are expected to rise for some time yet. The larger the epidemic grows, the more chance the virus has of finding vulnerable people who have not had their vaccine shots or are not sufficiently protected by the vaccine. While the vaccines dramatically weaken the link between cases and deaths, they are unlikely to break it entirely. The differences between coronavirus, influenza, and the vaccines that target them can easily eclipse a more fundamental issue, though. Learning to live with coronavirus as we live with flu does not mean society can take it in its stride. Every year, a comprehensive global surveillance network detects which variants of influenza are in circulation and most likely to pose a threat in the following season. That information determines which strains go into the annual flu vaccines that are then rolled out in established campaigns. Throughout the flu season, the public health authorities issue case counts and, if needed, update their advice on medical care. There is no such global system for coronavirus as yet. And despite the well-oiled machine that protects the world from flu, the death toll from the virus in a typical year is still substantial. Every winter, flu puts enormous stress on the National Health Service, the NHS, at times pushing it to breaking point. For the health service, living with coronavirus means learning to endure a double wave each winter as coronavirus and flu arrive together. researchers are working to establish whether the flu jab and a COVID vaccine can be given at the same time, as the NHS braces itself for a potential surge in cases of flu this winter. Experts say giving the two shots at the same time could save precious resources for the NHS by avoiding millions of unnecessary appointments. Adam Finn, Professor of Pediatrics at Bristol Medical School and a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said, "It isn't actually that difficult to give two injections at the same time. We do this in children all the time. But organizing totally different visits has a massive implication in terms of resources and time and so on." According to surveillance data largely encompassing England compiled by the Royal College of GPs, since the start of the pandemic, lockdowns, social distancing and mask wearing have reduced the risk of contracting not only COVID but other respiratory bugs as well, such as the flu, cases of which were basically non-existent last winter. Assuming that many of these measures are lifted in the coming months, a resurgence of flu viruses is expected. Graham Medley, a professor at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who chairs the SAGE subgroup on pandemic modelling, said, "I think we absolutely expect that contact rates will not be as low this coming winter as they were last winter. Restrictions will not be as heavy, and as a result, there will be a flu epidemic." Graham Medley said, "And because of the fact we didn't have one last winter, that might be a bit larger, or a lot larger, and I think that's something that focus will turn to as much as COVID in the future." The ComFluCov study is looking at what side effects people get when they are given a recommended flu vaccine alongside either the Oxford AstraZeneca or the Pfizer BioNTech jab, as well as the immune responses when the two shots are co-administered. Professor Finn said early results on the side effects when the two jabs are given together had been shared with the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. The study's chief investigator, Dr. Rayeka Lazarus, a consultant in infectious diseases and microbiology at University Hospitals Bristol and Western NHS Foundation Trust, said, "However, the official results are expected by August or September."
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson: why is debt bad? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Well, what exactly is wrong with having a little or a lot of debt? To start with, here are some of the problems debt can cause in your life. We've already gone over four of them. The fifth one is debt keeps you from reaching your financial goals. Monthly debt payments limit the amount of money you have to spend on other things, not just retirement, but the trip you always wanted to take or Eid gifts for your family. The more debt you accumulate, the more your monthly payments will be, and the less you have to spend on everything else. Number six, stress and serious medical problems. When you have debt, it's hard not to worry about how you are going to make your payments or how you will keep from taking on more debt to make ends meet. The stress from debt can lead to mild to severe health problems, including ulcers, migraines, depression, and even heart attacks. The deeper you get into debt, the more likely it is that you will face health complications. And at the end of the day, why were we buying all this stuff for? So we could potentially stay happy, right? Well, guess what? If you lose your health, happiness goes down the drain. That's the last thing on your mind then. Because health is that blessing that you want to protect. And getting into this debt-based, mortgage-based, interest-based system, it takes away not just the happiness, but even your health from you. You get into depression, and then it has consequences which we will talk over. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing why debt is bad. We have already gone over six serious issues with debt-based lifestyle. A lifestyle where you pay debt and you pay interest. When you take debt, when you take loan and pay interest over it. Last but not the least, for this series of issues with debt-based models and why debt is bad is that debt can hurt your marriage and your relationships. Brothers and sisters, debt puts unnecessary pressure on the household's finances and creates a lack of financial security for your spouse and your children. When both partners feel overwhelmed, it can spark arguments over spending habits. Who is creating more debt? And how much debt is too much? What is the definition of too much debt? So there are disagreements between spouses over that then. And then, oh, you bought this, that's why we're stuck now. We have to pay all this money and this interest because you made that purchase. And then, you know, the counterpart says, no, because of the car you bought, we got into this situation. If you would have gotten a simpler car, so on and so forth. You know how those arguments go on. These fights can escalate and lead to a breakdown in marriage. And we have seen many examples of this. If you look around, even in your relatives, your friends, your contacts, your peers, your co-workers, if you dig down into what problems they went through, rest assured, one of the problems in most of the cases, maybe not all, but most of the cases is that the debt the family had to pay for and the interest money was way too high. So again, the list of seven bad things about debt are: debt encourages you to spend more than you can afford, debt costs money, debt borrows from your future income, interest makes you pay more than the item cost, debt keeps you from reaching your financial goals, stress and serious medical problems, and debt can hurt your marriage. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.